Okay, good morning. It is Thursday, May 9th, and this is Henry Harris, and we're here for another week, another installment of the weekly teleforum, the weekly Emunah teleforum, and we are touching on the topic of Emunah, in particular, the psychological ramifications of Emunah, the realization, the clarity that there is a single, simple source behind everything, including our psychological experience, that the moment-to-moment-to-moment feelings we're having, the moment-to-moment-to-moment experience of our life is not coming from the variety of events and experiences that are happening in our lives. It can't work that way, even though it can look and feel like it's working that way. It certainly looks and feels like behaviors of others affect me, arouse certain feelings, or arouse certain upsets. It certainly looks like and feels like I am subject to a whole set of circumstances. But as my friend and colleague recently beautifully defined, Svi Werther, pointed out, that psychological freedom means freedom from all circumstance. Now, the irony is that the implication of freedom from all circumstance is that we are completely and wholly dependent upon divine energy, divine will, upon the creator of the universe. So I thought that was beautiful. Freedom, in the context of what we're looking at, what we've been celebrating since Passover and leading toward the upcoming holiday of Shavuos, the freedom that we're so excited by is the clarity, the understanding that we are absolutely not contingent on circumstances for the experience of our life, for anything. And of course, the beautiful implication is that we are completely and totally dependent on the only thing that there really is, which is divine energy, which is divine will. And therefore, we are going to experience what we're going to experience as a result of that divine energy, that divine will. Now, that doesn't mean that therefore we have control over how the divine energy and divine will shows up, but we have a wondrous opportunity to step aside from a falseness, from a falsehood. And what I have seen is that as I've seen clear from that falsehood, I'm quite happy. I'm thrilled to be dependent on exclusively and solely the one single power behind everything. Because, look, let's face it, you know, A, it's just true. B, we're not talking about like kind of a random force. We're talking about the all-powerful, all-loving mom and dad, you know, like that's an understatement. You know, the loving creator whose compassion and desire for our good is, it's something we can't begin to fathom. That's it. That's what is solely and wholly responsible for our experience. And the understanding of that, that recognition, is a tremendous mitzvah. That's a mitzvah of Emunah, to affirm that there is a single, simple power called God behind everything. And simultaneously, there is a tremendous mitzvah in denying the illusion of an alternative. As I'm experiencing an overwhelming perception of upset about a person's actions or a person's lack of actions, as I'm experiencing a feeling of being gripped, there's a tremendous opportunity to affirm, and this is what I understand to be what is referred to in the classic work, the title of the classic work called Chovos Halavavos, the duties of the heart. These are not duties of the limbs. These are not actions that you do, like putting on tefillin in the morning or shaking a lulav and etrog or placing a mezuzah on your house. These are duties of the heart. They are duties that you fulfill with this simple internal recognition. And there's a choice there. There's a profound and beautiful choice. And those choices of these internal natures are, they're just the most amazing foundational opportunities and commitments of being a Jew and being in this relationship with our Creator. So we have these incredible opportunities to fulfill the mitzvah of Emunah, to fulfill the mitzvah of not believing in God's or false powers, every time we acknowledge and affirm that this internal truth, and that's an extraordinary accomplishment, and we are priming ourselves to live and align with what's already true, and we will, rest assured, we won't lose. On the contrary, we'll only align ourselves in a way that our whole identity becomes uncomplicated, becomes independent of falsehood. We just position ourselves to be truly an extension of divine love, of divine power, of divine wisdom. We will become a natural extension, a natural projection of divine love, divine power, divine wisdom, to the degree that we align ourselves with the truth of the divine. It's just that simple. We will become a vehicle, a vessel. We don't have to understand how to become a vehicle of divine will, power, and wisdom. We don't have to understand that with our rational minds. It's enough to know that the truth about the divine. And of course, there's something so beautiful and simple in listening to the feelings that we're living in watching and wait, and watching and noticing the feelings that we're living in. Those feelings are wonderful data. They are such wonderful data to help point us toward a truth, to help us become reminded of the reality, of the truth of this simple nature. It's without need to know, without need to change those feelings. Those feelings are precious data, and they allow us to point ourselves toward truth without the need to change our feelings. That's what I'm seeing. That's what this call is about. And I wanted to speak specifically about something that I was so struck by in just this week's portion in one of the Rashis in the Parsha of Kedoshim, which really spells it out so clearly. I'm speaking these days with a gentleman who, unfortunately, at this point in time, he's got one foot out of the door of his home. He's been living in a marriage that, as far as he's concerned, has been toxic. His wife has been living in a very irresponsible and kind of unproductive place. And all she can do is find fault and blame for him, despite whatever he does that he thinks to be constructive and helpful. And he's frustrated. And he's really got a foot out the door. Now, what's noticeable to me in the conversation with him is that the two of them are locked in this kind of like resentment. You know, she is not doing well, and she's struggling, and she doesn't know what to do about it. He looks at her and is just like, what is your deal? You know, do you not see how irrational, irresponsible, and immature you're being? Can you get it together? You know, that's the message that underlies his approach to her, is that she's struggling, she doesn't know what to do about it, and he's judging her. Or at the very least, he doesn't have a lot of compassion for her lack of her struggle. Now, meanwhile, she's in pain, and the experience of feeling judged by him is just like salt, you know, just salt on these open wounds. So she's infuriated by his judgment of her. So all she can do, as far as she can tell, is to judge him back. What heartless, cruel, and terrible person you are. Now, meanwhile, he's doing things that are somewhat reasonably helpful, like these actions and these actions and these actions, which he sees to be, he's giving in on these matters, and he's giving on these matters, he's going out of his way to do favors for her. But all the while that he's doing this, it's accompanied by this perception, by this underlying kind of perception that, look, lady, I'm going out of my way for you, and you, not only are you doing poorly, you're not willing to acknowledge that you're doing poorly, and you're resentful of me that I'm going out of my way to help you. Like, you know, so they're locked in this kind of like mutual judgment. She's deeply, deeply hurt by his judgment because she's struggling, and the judgment just adds to the pain. And he's deeply hurt that he's going out. As far as he's concerned, he's taking what she dishes out, he's acting with a certain measure of generosity, and all she can do is kind of blast him. So they're locked in this mutual judgment, and it's not going well. So that's the scenario. Now, what he doesn't notice is that he is living in a judgment of her. He views her as a fundamentally an irresponsible and kind of flawed person. Like, hello, get it together. You know, what's your deal? He doesn't see the innocence behind her struggle. And so he's lived into a world where there's a reality that's not fully visible to him, that she is just a really defective human being. Now, what I was struck by in reading the verse that I read, toward the beginning of the portion, the verse says as follows: Al tifnu el ha'elilim, don't turn toward idols. Al tifnu el ha'elilim, don't, an elil is an idol. Ve'alohei masecha, and gods of form, like molten gods, gods that have been made through some physical form, don't make for yourselves. So the Torah speaks, the verse speaks of, uses two words to refer to idolatry. The first is an Elil, which is an idol. And then it says Elohei Masecha, which is typically the word for a god. So Rashi explains what's the word, why the two different words, and what's the kind of progression. Rashi says an Elil is made up of the root of the word Elil is Aleph Lamed. That means Al. Al is the word not. That's what it is. The word Al means not. An Elil, an idol, is a nothingness. It's an illusion. That's fundamentally what it is. It's a no existence entity. So the verse starts off, don't turn toward things of nothingness. Don't do that. Don't turn and give attention to things of nothingness, things that are an illusion. Now, why does it then right afterwards refer to idols with the word Elohei Masecha as the typical word for God? Because Rashi says, in the beginning, these things are a nothing. In the beginning, they're like an al. An al, again, is a nothing. In the beginning, techiloson alilim him. At the beginning, these are nothings. The imata pone achreim, and if you will turn toward them, if you will kind of seek and kind of pay attention to them, soifcha, in the end, your end will be las soison elohus. In the end, you will turn them. You will create them into a god. You will turn them into something that has actual substance. So they begin, they are in fact a nothingness. As you turn toward them, they become animated and animated until they occur to you as an absolute reality. What is going on in what we do in our lives is we turn toward, we ascribe power to something that, to a circumstance, to something of this world, to something that is itself a creation. And we associate that created form, whatever it is, a person, a circumstance, a place, an event, a memory, all of those exist in a world that is created. They all themselves are created entities. When we turn toward them and ascribe power to them as having actual influence, actual say, in the life that we live, in our psychological experience. And then ultimately, they become gods. They become influential. They actually take on power in our lives. Of course, they're not real. But for all intents and purposes, we live in a world in which we are bound by them, which we are driven and controlled by them. This gentleman, unfortunately, is presently mistaken about the power of his wife's choices, the power of his wife's behavior as a cause. He truly thinks that that her way of going about things are powerful, are causes. And it's unpleasant. He associates his difficulties and his suffering with her choices, with her way of doing and seeing things. And as a result, he's come to camp out and an outlook that says, look, this is a woman who's flawed. She comes from a family who's flawed. She's picking up in the tradition of her family. And it was visible to me way back when, before these conflicts were so real. But in other words, he maps out the whole world based on these initial mistaken conclusions. Why is she struggling so? It must be because she's, you know, again, I'll say this, my pain is coming from her. Obviously, there's something about her that is real and powerful and problematic. That's the beginning. My pain coming from her. What's wrong with her? There's something really wrong with her. Now let's start to build a worldview out of that. Now let's start to invest in and camp out in an outlook that says, you know, what she is a problem. And I need to, and I'm seriously considering dissolving my home and leaving, stepping away from my children as a result. And you know what? I don't say this, God forbid, to be judgmental. I'm just simply looking to illustrate what I see is a profound illustration of this idea that Rashi is laying out to us, that the Torah is laying out to us, that we start out turning to something that is an L. An L is an al. It means a not. It's a nothing. We turn toward it and associate it. We associate something that is nothing. We associate a nothing as being a something, and then it comes into its own. It takes on the identity of a real power that has a whole kind of organizing worldview. It becomes an idolatrous outlook that really takes on an existence of an existing power in our lives, and that's the power of our capacity. That's the power of thought. That's the power of this divine energy to take shape in our hearts and to come to life in a way that with misunderstanding, we will camp out. We will camp out and live in that false view with tremendous implications. Now, of course, the opportunity to awaken to that is profound. And that's the exciting news, that really what's so amazing about this is that what we can know is that really nothing has to change in order for our experience of life for everything about our experience of life to change. There's no circumstances that actually have to change in order for our experience to radically change because of our capacity to be mistaken. The human capacity to be mistaken is what saves us. Our willingness to acknowledge how human that is, our willingness to appreciate and live with the normalness of that is what can save us. It's what can allow us to let go of that illusion and thereby make room for new thought, for the newness of divine energy to show up and to touch us. That's what we're seeing. You're not on this call. You're not listening to this recording if you haven't seen that for yourself. The fact that it might not always be predictably available, that's another matter. But the truth is the truth, independent of what you're experiencing and feeling in this moment. Okay, those are my thoughts for today, and I've unmuted you, and I'm delighted to have you in this conversation. Please share, what are you seeing? What questions might you have about what we're touching on today?
I can make a comment.
Please.
I guess at the end of the day, the more we just realize that people...
Melissa, you're a little faint. Is there any way that you can speak a little closer to the microphone, or I don't know what you would
Is that
do?
Better? I think for some reason when my headphones are on, you don't hear me as well.
That's a little better, yeah. That's a little better, at least for me.
I think at the end of the day, the more we just all realize that everybody's kind of stuck in their own place, and, you know, whether they want to be stuck or they don't want to be stuck, or they're trying or what seems to be they're not trying, the more we kind of just look at ourselves more, even though that person looks like they're affecting us, so how could I look at myself when this person is clearly ruining my life? But the more we really kind of understand that the person is really not ruining your life, and if this person wasn't acting that way to you, someone else would, because this is obviously what you need from Hashem. It's a hard thing because people really think that this person, if this person wasn't doing A would not be happening to me. But they don't realize that A would be happening to you. It just would be happening from somebody else. And then you could be mad at that person instead. So the more we kind of can see the Hashem in it, which is very hard because, you know, it really, like you were saying, it just so looks like that person is doing it.
Right.
The more we can kind of just try to see what Hashem wants from me and why does Hashem keep sending this to me, and it just, again, focuses on me instead of the other person.
Yes.
And, you know,
yes.
It doesn't say, like, I know for me, like, there are times that if a certain gezeirah is over, all of a sudden that conversation I had 50 times, all of a sudden it hit. And the guy got it, or the girl got it, or the kid, and you're like, whoa, what? It hit, like, because it's over. Because it's over, not because the conversation hit. Because the guise, let's say, of this thing being over was, it looks like the conversation, the other person got it. It's really not what happened. It's really that it's over now. In other words, this kid doesn't need to do this anymore, let's say. So you're going to have, so the hishtadlut of it, or the, you know, the illusion can't just be out of the blue, the kid stops, right? Because that's like too miraculous almost. Hashem doesn't work like that. He wants it to be guised in nature. So it'll look like someone spoke to him and got through, or I spoke to him and got through. But it's really not true. It's really, it's time now. And I feel like it's a little bit of a heebie-jeebie thing to say, but I feel like the more we really see it, the more we're not so caught up in what the other person is doing. And not to say that we wouldn't get hurt, because, you know, even that, we're kind of to Hashem putting a thought in my head, which says I'm hurt, and we could know it's not real, but we feel it. You know,
we really
do feel it. So we can't just say, oh, it's not real, and therefore, no, it's not real, but I still feel it. And
that's
it's,
right.
It's hard. It's, you know, it's a hard thing. But
hard?
At the end of the day,
I don't understand what's hard. What do you refer to when you say it's hard?
I think feeling it is hard, and kind
feeling
of
it,
for me,
meaning
for me, the helpless of, like,
or feel it, or just feeling the pain.
No, to see, just feeling pain is not pleasant.
It's not pleasant.
I don't love it. I wish I could. I'm waiting for the day I could be at a place where I see that pain as so good that I'll really enjoy it. Because there is such a place, and it's really a truth. But I don't see that yet. Because I could one day.
Well,
allows me.
Well, Melissa, I'm going to suggest that you have a beautiful understanding of the truth of pain, a beautiful understanding about the nature of pain in many places and in many moments of your life.
For sure, that's true. That is,
like,
true. But
like the example I always give, you know, of the birth, right? Those contractions hurt. They hurt.
But
there's
still,
no way
but
around
we want an epidural. But we want an epidural.
Yeah, fine.
We really don't want not to have an epidural.
Right,
we can
but
get
when
out
those
of it,
pain,
we will.
You know, the painful moments definitely hurt. But when you, you know, celebrate your kid's birthday, it's not like you need to take a part of your day to just, you know, recuperate from the memory of the labor. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
All
but
of
so
that
that's
pain,
after the fact. Right.
Or after the fact,
after the
it's
pain
true,
is
but
over, of course you could reflect and say, wow, that was good. I'm talking about in the moment.
Okay.
More.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I mean
in the
more
moment,
in the
it
moment
hurts.
When you're really struggling for something, like yesterday I was in a class, so she was talking about a certain struggle. So she goes, the struggle in your mind, that's what she was saying, is the avodah. Should I buy it? Should I not buy it? Is that dress for sure siniyut, or maybe it's really not, but I can maybe get away with it, and I don't know. And that, she goes, that struggle that you didn't buy the dress at the end, she said, that's the avodah. It feels horrible. It's hard. Your body's killing you, and your mind is going back and forth, and because you want it, but you really know you shouldn't have it, or vice versa. And she said, that's the avodah. She said, that struggle is what Hashem loves. That pain in your body. Of,
yes, there is. There is definitely.
That's what she was saying.
Yep. There is a healthy pain, an effort in
right
in looking toward something beyond our own personal thinking.
or just trying to get yourself to do the right thing, or not knowing it 100% yet, and struggling in your head.
And there is an temptation of relief in wallowing in personal thought.
For sure.
There's a definite. I can relate to that. I just had an experience of that this week where I was like, you know, I really wanted to make someone wrong and live in that feeling of blame.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of noticed it, and I appreciated it for a moment. Like, wait a second, there's definitely a certain exemption from real responsibility if I go here, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I definitely will get a pass in standing up to my responsibilities and commitments if I kind of, you know, look in the direction of blame.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a comfort in letting go of that pass.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, I have a client this week that said to me, it's a new client, so we were just introducing it. So he said, well, what if I want to be angry? I said, kol hakavod, like, be angry. I said, like, you can do whatever you want, but, like, there's a feeling that comes with it, you know what I'm saying? And he was just like, yeah, I guess it's fun for a while, but then at the end of the day, like, it doesn't really get me anywhere. I said, yeah, like, we're not here to tell you not to feel, but in other words, you know, just know you're feeling it. Don't blame it on the other guy. You know what I'm saying?
That's true.
Like, he understood that, you know what, sometimes I really want, and I said, me too. Sometimes I'm just like, right now I'm not in a good place and I'm good with that. And so it's not that I don't know, in other words, I would rather not be good with it. I would rather, you know, not get caught in the trap of that. But I guess it's all part of what we wanted, because we all want to do the right thing. Everyone's good. That's the thing. So when we're not picking the choice that, let's say, is choose life, right, then there is going to be an underlying, you know, healthy part of us saying, you didn't choose life. Like, you know, or Hashem, you're not letting me choose life, you know. And, you know, I have one girl that she has so much fear, and she really gets this. And she's like, I keep asking Hashem, take it. She goes, he doesn't take it. She goes, they're stuck. I can't get them out of my head. I said, okay, so until he takes it, he doesn't take it. You know, she got it. She understood. But she's in so much pain all the time because she has a lot of fear going on in her head. But she's kind of like, she understood. She said, I'm stuck with this until he takes it. So she said, because it's there. So it's true. It's like you have a cut and it's hurting. Until Hashem lets the pain on your arm stop, it's not stopping. You could put the Neosporin. You could put, you know what I'm saying, Mike?
So
I guess that was my comment. If it was a comment, I don't know.
I always enjoy your insights.
Thank you.
Anyone else? The floor is open. I'll share one other thought. Well, if people want to consider the following, I was very pained by the most recent episode in Israel where there was this massive barrage of terror missiles that really just, it just terrorized a whole swath of the people of Israel. It's very painful. And then on top of that, the pain of the accusations, the awful justifications of those terrorist actions. Well, of course, these people have no choice because they're being oppressed and they're being occupied. So, of course, they're desperate. Of course, they have to take measures in their own hands. And yes, they make extreme actions. But what, you know, like these justifications from various parties in the world at large that justify the terror and then vilify Israel for responding. I couldn't help but notice the intense upset that I felt. And it was just, I was curious to kind of look at it and consider whether there was something to learn about it. And here's what came to me. You know, we live in a state of exile. The Jewish people are currently, we're in a state of exile. And the nature of exile is to be living, the essence of exile is an illusion. the idea that the world is, that the temple is destroyed, that the Jewish people are scattered and kind of, you know, diminished, that the crown of the king is kind of diminished and not held aloft. That's the state of affairs as it is presently. It's not visible to the world and openly that God is noticeable in his ascendance, that his people are ascended. That's not present. And of course, the challenge is to be, for us, is to look at those circumstances and to say, well, obviously that's because that's what's, you know, that's the reality, that the circumstances define us. And of course we should, we're in a downtrodden state, so we should feel downtrodden. Now, of course, the opportunity is to acknowledge the truth and what's inner, what's the truth that's inside, the inner world, the truth that is not revealed, but is true no less because it's not revealed. It's still absolutely true. And the way that it occurs to me that we see that, like the opportunity of exile, is to be confronted with a falsehood and still to be able to find the truth in a peaceful, deep place inside of us. When someone speaks to you, if someone were to say to you, I don't know, something crazy, if somebody were to accuse you of being, I don't know, of having six arms, you know, if he were to accuse you of having six arms, there's a good chance that it would not arouse in you a feeling of threatened, a feeling of insulted. It would seem ridiculous to you. Now, you might see fit, if it's necessary, to point out the mistake or to point out the lie in such a statement. But the degree to which it doesn't arouse a feeling of insecurity, a feeling of threatened, is because you have a simple clarity that it's not so. You don't have six arms, right? So I think the same thing is true in the opportunity of our exile. When the Jewish people are confronted with lies, you're a bunch of terrorists, you're Nazis, you're defending yourself against terror rockets and in a manner that it kills people, you're Nazis, to the degree that it animates in me an insecure, threatened, angry feeling, not there's such a thing as a healthy anger, I'm not questioning that, but I'm speaking for myself. I noticed agitation in myself, and I could see and feel agitation in the efforts that people I could see responding to this in various forums. I could see and feel their feelings of defensiveness and their kind of reactiveness to it. And it occurred to me that it's being confronted. We're being confronted by a sense of, do we pay attention to, do we give credence to this world, the perceptions of the players of this world, the talk and the chatter of this world, or do we live in and reside in a simple depth of clarity, a simple truth that is not of this world? It has nothing to do with people agreeing with us or people not agreeing with us, that our relationship with truth is that it has nothing to do with a vote or popularity or an affirmation from sources outside in this world. In fact, the gullus that we find ourselves in, the gullus of Edom, of Rome, it's associated with the Edom is, according to our sages, is associated with the chazir, with the pig. The pig is an entity that has one sign of a kosher animal, which is its external sign. The two signs of a kosher animal, one is that it has cloven hooves, which is visible. The other is that it ruminates, it chews its cud, which is not visible to the eye. It refers to an internal connection to something. The pig, which is the symbol of our current exile, is completely and totally focused on the external. The form of this world is what matters. Everything is, all success and all measures of worth and all measures of good are measurable in a kind of, in a world of form. how many people agree with you, how many friends do you have likes from on Facebook. All of this world is really what kind of matters. That's what measures kind of value and success. And we're living in a world that worships and identifies with the form of this world. And when we are encountering something that is, when we encounter something that agitates us, it's an opportunity. I'm seeing, this is for me, I'm seeing, where do I stand in my allegiance to the value of the form of life? Or where do I stand in my connection to the simple truth of life, the truth that exists independent of form? I, of course, am interested in speaking truth to the falsehood of all these vilifications of Israel. But it's interesting to me, when I noticed my kind of insecure feeling, my feeling of threatenedness, that's a sign for me that I've given attention and value to the world of form. It's a beautiful litmus test for me, and that's exactly, to me, what the discomfort and agitation of exile is. It's like a beautiful litmus test to see how much can we live in a world of illusion and yet be unbound by it, uninfluenced by it, by virtue of our connection to a truth that totally transcends that. It's just a beautiful litmus test. And that's, of course, true in any experience of life. In a relationship, we are also confronted by our allegiance and our attachment to the form. You know, I don't like it when someone disapproves of me, and I'll disapprove of them back. Well, that's an indication of our lack of connection to that inner truth, our mistaken identification with the form of life. How much do people think of me? How much does my spouse approve of me? How much do my kids, you know, respond or like me? All of that is simply a litmus test of being confronted by a falsehood, and thereby seeing how much am I moved by that falsehood? How much do I have an attachment to that falsehood? And there's a discomfort in discovering that. There's a real discomfort in seeing my attachment to that illusion, but it's a beautiful and profound training ground. You know, as marriage is a beautiful training ground, exile is a beautiful training ground. All of this is a training ground to kind of confront my agitation points to the degree to which I am invested in a falsehood. And then I can start to look in a new direction. It's a beautiful litmus test. Well, it could very well be that we're good. I want to wish you a beautiful week and a good Shabbos, and I'm looking forward to new opportunities to hear from you folks, your insights, your stories of understanding, your questions.